once again to our series, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. Our guest, once again, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who is a teacher of religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick's here in Terre Haute at 19th and Poplar Street, where the Shamrock is at the intersection of the streets. Ron, welcome once again. We've been discussing St. Thomas's five proofs for the existence of God very briefly, and then you gave us a good introduction as to why reasons to believe have sort of shifted into experiential, or what people themselves have experienced, that even Pope John Paul II the Great and Pope Benedict XVI tend to use that type of reasoning today. So we just finished some beautiful sayings or statements by Father Aidan Nichols about various experiences from wonder, from conscience, from mystical experiences that speak to us. There must be somebody beyond ourselves, some creative or intelligent supreme being. We're up now to God's proof of existence from the historical argument. Many Catholic converts have read themselves into the Catholic Church by studying history. So could we say, begin some statements about what is the historical argument?
I believe it was John Henry Newman made a statement, something to the effect, back in the mid-19th century. He was an Anglican, a theologian of great renown, and even with as an Anglican. And he was a convert to the Catholic faith, and later on became a cardinal before the end of the 19th century.
And contributed a lot to Vatican Council II thinking.
And he was one who certainly read his way into the Catholic Church. In fact, as a Protestant, he had done a great deal of research on the Church Fathers, and it was this history, studying of history, that basically made him see that the Catholic Church was the Church that indeed was, established by Jesus Christ. And he made a comment, something to the effect one time, that anyone who knows history would just see that the Catholic Church is the Church, of course, that was established by Jesus Christ. And at least that was his experience, of course.
Yeah. And he had a great struggle spiritually in finally coming into the Catholic Church.
Oh, certainly.
Because it had to change his whole way of thinking from being a very devout Anglican.
Well, getting into your question, this historical argument, what is this historical argument? The fact that peoples of all societies and times have had some form of religious belief has led some to conclude that God exists. Sociologically and anthropologically speaking, religion tries to offer answers to the universal questions of mankind. That is, how and why do we exist? What meaning and purpose does life hold for us? What is our destiny? What, if any, control do we have over our lives and destiny? What are the causes of suffering, sorrow, and death in the world? What are the related ones? What are the causes of evil in the world? Are there any reasons for hope in a world of darkness and despair? The fact that all men have sought answers to these and other fundamental questions in all times is reasonable proof that God exists. Peter, we're going to look at the ideas of a man by the name of Peter Kreeft, or Kreft. Let's just pronounce it Kreeft.
Okay.
And he is a professor of philosophy at Boston College,
okay,
which is a Catholic college, really more of a university. They still call it college, but it's actually...
And I believe he's a rather renowned convert.
Yes, and in fact, he actually studied under C.S. Lewis, the great British Anglican theologian. And philosopher at Oxford, I believe he was at. We're going to look at his historical arguments, Peter Kreeft's historical arguments. First, he says that history, both human and pre-human, shows a storyline. It is not just random. Furthermore, he says that a story points to a storyteller. And the general argument from history is a version of the argument from design.
Okay.
So, in other words, what he's saying is that the story of human beings, it has the history of human beings, it just simply has a storyline. The term he uses, the storyline.
Right, now you have to help me a little with that. What does that mean? It has a storyline, that there is connection with it. There are reasons behind it.
Yes, that's essentially the idea. It's not just something that ran at random.
Okay.
It's not just something that just simply falls in place automatically.
Okay.
There's something that connects it. Something that holds it together.
Causation.
Yes. There's where you're getting into the idea of design.
Okay.
Something had to design this. Okay. We would call this, in theology, divine providence.
Okay. That would be a good explanation.
That is, God's plan. Which is a part of salvation history.
There is a plan for God, or God's plan working out in the world. It was that famous Danish theologian, Kierkegaard, who said, we live our lives looking forward, and we understand our lives looking backward. We can see how the pieces fit together in some kind of a design, and that would be divine providence.
And that's why Creese says that this is an argument from history, which is essentially a version of the design argument.
Okay. Well, how about the second argument, historical argument, that he gives?
Well, the second argument concentrates on history's moral design. Kreeft tells us that the historical books of the Old Testament are an argument for the existence of God from the justice displayed in the history of the Jewish people. He says that their experience is the perfect invitation to see the hand of God in human affairs. Whenever God's laws are followed, the people prosper. When his laws are violated, the people perish. And in fact, the Jews were almost wiped out, at least on four occasions in Old Testament history, because the Israelites had broken their covenant with God. I teach a course where we go into that whole story, and as I said, there was at least four different times that remember the covenant, the agreement between God and man. Beginning with, actually went all the way back to Adam, but let's start with Abraham. Yeah. Abraham, and then renewed with Isaac, and then Jacob, of course, and then 400 years later with Moses, and then, of course, with David. And in this covenant or this agreement, God promised the people that if you obey my commandments, if you do my will, if you worship me as the one true God, I will give you land, and I will give you numbers of people, like the sands in the sea and, the stars in the sky. He tells Abraham this. I will give you prosperity. I will give you peace. All kinds of things for these Israelites.
All sorts of material blessings.
But then you obey my commandments and do my will. Well, when they did, they prospered. But what would happen invariably is that when they prospered, then they tend to get slack. Then they tend to start getting materialistic and hedonistic, that is, pleasure-seeking. And then they would start worshiping idols and committing
the pagans around them.
Yes, and breaking the other Ten Commandments, particularly the Sixth Commandment and what have you. And then God would send a prophet to warn them what they had done, that they better straighten up, and here's what's going to happen to you if you don't straighten up. Well, for the most part, the Israelites tended to beat up the prophets and throw them outside the city walls, or to stone them to death, or whatever the case may be. But then they'd be punished. And then they're punished. This would bring them to their knees for a little while, and then they would repent of their sins, and then they'd straighten up a little while. And then they'd start prospering again. And then when they started prospering again, then they'd fall again. They'd start backsliding, and then they would fall again. Another prophet, same story. It goes on and on and on. In fact, when you read the Old Testament, essentially it's a sort of a cyclical kind of thing as you go through that whole process of prosperity and then
falling
away,
turn against
and then,
God,
and then the backsliding,
turn back to God,
the backsliding, and then the prophets and their warnings, and then the punishment, and then
it sounds sort of like what happens to all of us.
Yes. Oh, yes. We can certainly see this in the, you know, in the world today, and particularly with the American people, I think, who've been blessed more than any with material things more than any other people in the history of the world by far.
Sure.
But nonetheless, the idea is that this, you can see with the Israelites here, as Kreeft is talking about, the hand of God in all of these things. It's easy to see.
And fortunately, the Israelites were able to decipher the hand of God at work in their prosperity and in their punishment.
Well, Kreeft points out that history shows that moral laws are inescapable, as are any physical laws. Just as one can't flout the laws of gravity, or he falls, one can't flout God's laws, or he falls as well.
That's good.
And to illustrate this, he gives an example of great tyrants like Hitler, who flourished for a time, and then they perished. And on the other hand, great saints seem to suffer failure, then they triumph. The same goes for nations. He says that history proves that individuals or nations can't violate the moral laws without suffering bad consequences. And the only satisfactory cause for such effects is God. Being a teacher of history, I'm acutely aware of the truth of this argument for God's existence. One could easily find hundreds of examples to illustrate the truth of this argument. And we examine many of these in my course in World and U.S. History at John Paul Catholic High. That's one of the reasons I'd never be able to teach in a public school, because you wouldn't really be able to really get at the heart and soul and of a historical causation.
Of God at work in the world today and in past.
Certainly, you can go a long way towards explaining things and from a purely secular cause and effect type relationship, but ultimately there's some much deeper cause to how history is unfolding.
I always think of the fall of the Berlin Wall. There are many explanations politically for that, but it seems to fit in well with the Fatima promises that if Russia would be consecrated to the Blessed Virgin and her son Jesus, then somehow communism without warfare would disintegrate and melt down, which it actually did.
For those who, you know, lived through that period of the Cold War, the idea that the Soviet Union would have, it was almost like a fixture. It was almost like something that was getting more monolithic, more powerful, more much greater. And the idea that just in almost a year or two that it would simply collapse would have been almost unfathomable. It just simply something you would never could have believed that would have happened. So something had to be the finger of God, the hand of God had to be in that. But, we know, as you just mentioned, we know about Fatima and the promises there and the warnings there and all that kind of thing and how these things actually really did were fulfilled.
It was an amazing, startling event when that began to happen.
Yes.
Well, okay, let's go back to Peter Kreeft. He has what is called providential coincidence. when I see that, Ron, I think of coincidence. There's a saying, coincidence is God at work but wanting to remain anonymous. Okay, what is his providential coincidence
argument? Well, Peter Kreeft gives an example. For example, the Red Sea parting, moved by an east wind, according to Exodus. Just at the right time for the Jews to escape, Pharaoh's army. He describes how our own individual histories usually have similar bits of curious timing. He says that unprejudiced examination of these coincidences, he has this in quotations, coincidences, will bring at least a suspicion, if not the conviction, that an unseen divine hand is at work. And I think many times in my own life, I've seen the hand of God in events that affected my life and my family's life. The occurrences were too well timed to be nothing more than just simply, you know, coincidences. And I think time and time again we encounter these providential coincidences when I teach my history class, we constantly are coming into these providential coincidences in history.
I spent 3 days on retreat down at a place called Cathedral Gardens, just about a half hour north of Louisville at a little town, Henryville. But it's 15 acres of beautiful ponds and yellow lily pads and 1,500 different kinds of trees and flowers. A magnificent paradise on earth. But the guy who gives a little introduction before you go through the gardens says, many people say this really didn't happen, but he says, I know it happened. It was the hand of God, because I was losing my business, and I prayed all night one night, and I was saved from bankruptcy. I was able to sell my computer business and for several million dollars, and then I decided I should do something to give honor and glory to God and Jesus Christ. And Cathedral Gardens, he spent over 13 years building that from a mud hole, and it's a beautiful place worth seeing. And if you listen to the man, he may say, other people may not believe me, you don't have to believe me, but I know it was the hand of God that delivered me, and I wanted to do something in return.
I think about everybody gets in times in their life when there just seems to be no answer for a problem, a very, very serious problem in their life, and yet all of a sudden, almost in an instant, something happens which you never thought would have been possible to solve that problem.
It's like, as you mentioned, the deliverance of the Israelites running from the Egyptian forces who were going to either annihilate them or bring them back into slavery, and suddenly the Red Sea opens, and you can give it all kind of natural causes and the like, but that's a providential coincidence that Peter Kreeft is talking about. Okay, what's the fourth historical argument that Peter Kreeft asks us to consider?
Well, this is one of the strongest of all, and this is the miracles. There are powerful motives of credibility. Remember, we spent the first several sessions of this series on explaining motives of credibility, in other words, reasons to believe, that make it reasonable to believe in God's existence and his divine providence. And we'll discuss this topic, that is, miracles, in much more detail later on in a different context. But for now, we will say that miracles directly show the presence of God. For a miracle, in the ordinary sense of the word, is a deed done by a supernatural, not a natural power. Kreeft tells us that if miracles happen, they demonstrate God's existence as clearly as rational speech shows the existence of thought.
If somebody's talking logically,
yes,
then they must have reason.
In other words, if miracles exist, then God exists. It's that simple.
Because it's something that has no natural explanation.
Right. For an event to be classified as a miracle, it must be extraordinary. That is, not an occurrence in the ordinary course of events. Moreover, the context in which a miracle occurs must be religious and cannot have a natural explanation. Otherwise, extraordinary events that are not in a religious context or can be explained by natural occurrences are merely what we would call oddities or curiosities or strange happenings, as is found in Ripley's Believe It or Not, or something of that sort. As I said, we're going to spend quite a bit of time later on talking about miracles in much more detail.
And they are all through the New Testament,
right,
and even the Old Testament.
And they've occurred ever since then, all the way down to the present day, and even in our own present day. And I'm not talking about what some people would call, you know, coincidences that we were talking about a while ago. I'm talking about an actual intervention of God directly in the natural world.
I heard a prominent politician say not so long ago on the radio, and I've forgotten his name, but he was asked, do you believe in miracles? And he said, oh, yes, I'm a realist. I thought that was a nice combination of the two. There's sometimes no other explanation. or what is happening?
We never went into the syllogism, but I'll give you Peter Kreis here without, you know, giving all the logic behind it. He starts out with a major premise. A miracle is an event whose only adequate explanation is the extraordinary and direct intervention of God. And then if you have what we call a minor premise. There are numerous well-attested miracles. That is history. You just look at history and there are just, you know, thousands of them. And then he draws a conclusion from that. Therefore, there are numerous events whose only adequate explanation is the extraordinary and direct intervention of God. Therefore, God exists. That's an example of the use of a syllogism.
Sure.
And we could have used those to look at all of the various arguments of St. Thomas Aquinas in his five ways, which we decided to forego.
And, of course, a syllogism can be a sophistry, because the major premise or the minor premise might not be true.
That's true if they're not true. Right.
And that's the way we figure out whether a syllogism is correct or not.
So you just get false arguments.
False discerning.
Well, Kreis says that if he were an atheist, he would study all the published interviews of any of the 70,000 who saw the miracle of the sun at Fatima. This was in 1917, if I recall right, in October of 1917. That he would ransack hospital records for documented impossible miraculous cures. He states that atheists argue against nearly all miracles on philosophical grounds rather than historical grounds. They are convinced and advanced by argument, that is, by rational arguments, that miracles can happen. And as a consequence, they don't waste their time on empirical investigation. He says that those who do soon cease to be atheists, like the skeptical scientist who investigated the Shroud of Turin.
Shroud of Turing being the cloak that is reputed to have wrapped Jesus in the tomb.
Oh, yes, there have been numerous
and there seems groups. To be all sorts of historical scientific evidence of that. It's really an authentic shroud.
It really has been put under the scrutiny of scientific investigation with some of the most modern instrumentation available.
Carbon testing and all that.
And then there's a man by the name of Frank Morrison that he mentions, who investigated the evidence for the myth of Christ's resurrection with the careful scientific eyes of the historian, and he became a believer. There's hardly a scientist who opens his mind to the truth that remains an atheist.
Okay, go ahead.
And I believe that a careful study of these arguments, that we are forced to conclude that it is reasonable to believe that God exists, these type of historical arguments, and the miracles particularly.
Okay, I don't know Frank Morrison. Do you know Frank Morrison?
No, I'm not familiar with him. Couldn't find any more out on him.
Well, of course, as you say, there are hundreds of scientists who, by studying history and whether miracles had a reason, sufficient reason to be authenticated, finally concluded, I've got no other way reasonably to go but accept these fantastic, what we would call them fantastic, out of the beyond ordinary explanation events. I believe at Lourdes, the Shrine of Miracles, ever since 1858, since the Blessed Virgin appeared there to Bernadette, there have been hundreds and thousands of miracles, but they only have something like 80 or so that have been authenticated with all kind of records. And of course, recently, the miracle out at St. Mary's of the Woods was accepted for Mother Theodore's canonization from the workman who was cured of an impossible eye difficulty, and he had all the records and the like, and they sent them to Rome, and it was accepted as something that had no possible natural explanation.
Later in the series, we're going to spend a whole session dealing with that whole process of verifying these miracles in a little bit different context, and we'll look at Lourdes, and especially Lourdes, in other words, what are the criteria that the church uses to verify the truth of these, that these really truly are miraculous.
Which is very, very strict.
Oh, yeah, very strict.
From a scientific viewpoint.
In fact, it's interesting. At times, things that scientists say, hey, there's absolutely no scientific explanation for this. Scientists won't say it's a miracle. They just say, hey, there's no scientific explanation for it. And then they leave it to the church to declare, you know, well, this is a miracle. In other words, it's an intervention of God in setting aside his own laws. And the church is really, there are many times that the scientists will say there's no explanation, but the church still, for various reasons, will not accept that as a verified miracle. Maybe personally, you know, the various people even on the committee or the commission might say, yeah, I think it's miraculous, but see, the church wants to be absolutely sure, you know, because of the matter of credibility, of course.
Sure. Okay. Well, do you want to go on to the fifth historical argument? We have just a couple of minutes, but we may be able to tackle that.
Well, one of the arguments is Christ himself, according to Peter Crift, a man who lived among us and claimed to be God. And if Christ was God, then of course there is a God. But if Christ was not God, he was a madman or a devil or something else, if he really thought he was God and he was not. And a devil, if he knew he was not God and yet tempted men to worship him. Kreeft asked the question, which is he? Is Lord or lunatic or liar?
I think that's so well put poetically, but also a nice summary. Those are the only three possibilities.
Yes.
That Jesus was Lord, God made man as he claimed to be. He was a lunatic. That he thought he was God, but he really wasn't, or he was a liar.
Well, Kreeft tells us that part of the data of history is the gospel record of Jesus' life, from which an absolutely unforgettable character emerges from reading. He says that Christ's personality is compelling even to non-believers or unbelievers, even to his enemies, like the atheistic German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, in the late 19th century. And Kreeft says that the character revealed in the gospel accounts is utterly unlike that of a lunatic or a liar, that it is impossible for a lunatic to be so wise or a liar to be so loving. Therefore, Jesus must be who he claims to be, that is, God. Now, we're going to spend some time, in fact, at least a whole session, just on this issue later on, and again, in a little bit different context. So we'll wait till we get to that point before we, go into this. In other words, we're going to wait till we get to a point where we're going to look at proving that Jesus Christ is God.
God.
Now we're just trying to prove that God exists.
That God exists.
Yes.
Okay. And I've often heard people say that Jesus, most people that I talk to say, at least Jesus was a very good person. Okay, if we start with that, he was very good, well, then he wouldn't be lying. If he was very good, he wouldn't be unbalanced or a lunatic. So there's nothing left to accept what he says. I and the Father are one. He who sees me sees the Father and the like. So I think if we pursue that to its final reasoning, we've got to take one of the three, liar, lunatic, or Lord. So this concludes our session for today. May God bless you always and in all ways.